I felt a crunch.
My knee buckled to the outside.
An experience that's becoming common among serious young athletes. I'm Maiken Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
It's not too cumbersome. The suit's pretty flexible. It just gets a little hot inside.
You ferment it, dry it, and then roast it.
You have to be on point every single day.
They want that medication. They use the coupon. But then the coupon goes away.
I want to eat more of this.
That substance
and I don't
want
to move at all. I just want to sit around.
And
that's
the problem.
Putting the word chemical on something to make it as scary out of it.
Can it be loud?
Oh, my God.
On today's show, you want to grow old, right? But how old, really? Two medical ethicists will debate this question. Also, baking as a frontal lobe workout, smart gadgets for fitness fans, and leftovers deconstructed. But first up, it's Thanksgiving weekend, which means lots of football will be played. For young athletes, concussions have been a huge topic of conversation and concern. And of course, we're not just talking about football players here, but there's another emerging trouble spot, knee injuries. Tanya English reports.
Yes, the thigh bone's connected to the shin bone, and the ACL is a rubbery cord that connects those bones at the knee. The anterior cruciate ligament is supposed to keep the knee stable when you stop suddenly or change direction quickly. When the ACL tears, lots of athletes end up in surgery. Doctors and nurses at Nemours Children's Hospital in Wilmington, Delaware, are prepping their biggest patient of the day.
All right, this is a timeout for Brennan Weber. He's allergic to Augmentin and dog hair. He weighs 82.4 kilograms, and today he's here for a left.
Orthopedics
knee
had to find an extra long bed for high school senior Brennan Weber. He's 6'4". He has size 17 feet. On the football field, you can barely keep him still. But right now, Brennan is knocked out, under anesthesia, and everyone around him is busy.
So if you look over here, this is his thigh bone, this is his shin bone.
Pediatric surgeon Alatonda makes small holes in Brennan's knee, then uses a tiny camera to look inside and take pictures. Images of bone and cartilage flash on TV monitors all around the room.
Yeah, it's like playing a video game. It's all about hand-eye coordination. You're not looking at the knee, you're looking at the screen, so you have to know where your hands are in space.
Atonda shaves down the torn ligament and cleans up ragged cartilage to prepare a space for Brennan's new ACL. Enough kids have gotten hurt on the playing field that the Children's Hospital has opened a center for sports medicine. Atonda says the average surgeon does maybe 8 reconstructions each year. He fixes 1 or 2 ACLs every week.
Layer by layer, it takes some time. You just take your time and get through. Then you get down to the layer that's right on top of the tendon.
For the next step, the surgeon harvests a portion of tissue attached to Brennan's kneecap.
So this whole big white thing is his tendon.
It takes a saw to get the tendon out, but that piece of tissue is the graft that will replace Brennan's old ACL.
You don't always have to repair it, but in a young, active person who wants to return to athletic participation, it's highly recommended that they have it fixed.
In the weeks before surgery, getting back to football was all Brennan Weber talked about.
I drive around with a football in my truck, and I sleep with a football ever since I was probably like 10.
Brennan plays safety for Polytech High School near Dover. Even after his injury, he shows up to watch the Panthers practice. He's been on the sidelines since the very first game this season.
Panthers on 3. 1, 2, 3, Panthers!
I went backwards to go catch a ball over my left shoulder. I came down, caught the ball, and I hyperextended my leg and buckled my knee, and I just fell forward straight on my face.
He knew he was hurt, but convinced the athletic trainer to put him in the game anyway.
I kind of like put on like a little show for him on the sideline just to show him that I'm fine. I mean, any football player in that position, first game of the season, would definitely do the same, I think. You just couldn't think anything else besides just getting back into the game.
Oh, Brennan's done for the year, and that's what the hardest thing is. You got a kid that has worked hard his senior year, has a chance to play in college.
Coach Kevin Smith says the team's training and preparation haven't changed, but he has 3 hurt players this season.
New to me, I've been doing this 14 years. I've never seen this many knee injuries before.
We're struggling a little bit on the defense side of the ball, okay?
It's not clear if more kids are actually getting hurt or if more teens are simply playing at highly competitive levels. But some young athletes have become super specialized. That means they play the same sport all year round, using the same muscles. That leaves young athletes less time for rest and recovery.
Okay, we've got to pin them back. We've got to make them drive more.
Brennan decided on surgery because he says that's his best chance to play Division II football in college. But before that, he has months and months of rehab ahead.
Oh, man, the comeback, the plan is definitely to be back playing football, basketball, everything in 9 months, 8 months, hopefully quicker than that. I feel like I can definitely return quicker than that.
What I'm concerned about is their expectations are very high. Because the surgery is a big deal. The surgery is quite invasive.
Physical therapist Lynn Snyder-Mackler says many young athletes underestimate what it takes to recover.
You know, in 6 months or so, they probably have their strength back, they have their motion back, it's not swelling, but that graft isn't healed. And that's the part you can't rush biology.
Snyder-Mackler is a researcher at the University of Delaware, where she has a $5 million grant to study what she calls downstream injuries.
The younger and more active the patient is, the higher the rate of re-injury. And in girl, high school girls, it's about 30%. That's really high, of either re-tearing that graft or tearing the other ACL.
This exercise requires 30 reps.
There are videos and group exercises designed to help avoid ACL injury.
We are focusing on the landing while trying to keep the knees and feet from caving inward.
They urge players to absorb shock with their hips, not the knees.
Forward and backward hops, single leg hops.
Snyder-Mackler says proper technique can be taught and eventually become natural and instinctive over time and with a little bit of training. Sports surgeons have always known they will see some of their ACL patients again. But Snyder-Mackler says the newest research shows that it's young athletes who are especially at risk for needing another fix.
This is really new information that we're trying to trickle down to the clinicians, right?
Stay tuned, she says. The physical therapists at the University of Delaware are trying to figure out what it takes to prevent a second injury. For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
Two zoom zero stalker.
Two zoom zero stalker.
Oh, by the way, think about this.
Two zoom.
Alex Winchester, torn MCL, done for the year. Another one.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Maiken Scott. From football and all of its perils, on to another main ingredient in Thanksgiving weekend, shopping. So-called wearable technologies will again be huge this year. Apparently, the Consumer Electronics Association predicts 1 in 10 shoppers will buy a fitness tracking device for themselves or a loved one. Innovations reporter Todd Bookman is here now to talk about the latest options. Hi, Todd.
Hey, Maiken.
So 1 in 10 shoppers will buy one of these things, so I guess this trend is not going away.
No. These are here to stay. Last year, global sales alone were around $240 million. This year, consumers are going to have well over 100 different fitness tracking gadgets to choose between, and, you know, most share the same basic functions. They can track your heart rate, the steps that you step, the miles that you run. Many also count calories burned, and also the wearer's sleep cycles.
So what are going to be the most popular options then?
So I put a call into an expert on this stuff, Jill Duffy. She's senior analyst at PC Mag, and she's big on the $199 Basis Peak watch.
So what's really cool about it is you never have to put it into sleep mode or running mode. It just automatically detects whatever it is you're doing. So I think this is one of the best trackers for most people just because it automates everything. It's at a decent price. It's comfortable to wear. It looks good. I really love it.
What does this thing look like?
Yeah, so it looks like a sort of high-tech watch. It's fairly well-designed. It's not too geeky. There's definitely a digital display on your wrist. So, I'm not sure I'd wear it on a date, but it's okay.
You can wear it to go running and such.
That would be an appropriate look, yes.
All right. Now, looks aside, do these things actually do anything for us? Do they make us healthier, fitter, better people?
There's not really much good research out there yet that compares the fitness results of people that have these gadgets with those that don't. You know, if your goal here in giving one of these as a present this year is to get somebody off the couch, you may be disappointed. One study I found says that within 6 months of purchase, about 1/3 of users had completely given up on the gadgets. And another issue is that some academics have proven that not all of these devices are all that accurate when it comes to estimating the calories burned. So if you're going to get one, it may be worth doing a little research first on which are the better models.
Todd, what are some future trends when it comes to these healthy wearables?
So Jill Duffy says the next wave in wearable technology, and she says this could be a really big wave, is going to be in medical devices. So tracking patients while they're at home.
Imagine this. If you have a device that reads your heart rate all the time, and it's going to a platform, and that platform is on the internet and can be shared with other people, you suddenly have a way for your doctor to monitor you remotely.
Duffy says there are already devices being introduced in hospital settings that can track patients before discharge. So we're probably not too far off from seeing these technologies at home.
All right. But that's not going to be on our holiday shopping list this year.
Not this year.
What if I'm not into fitness devices, but I still would like to keep my weight down and all that? Any options out there?
Yeah, consider the Happy Fork. It's a smart utensil that encourages slower eating at meals by vibrating if you start chowing down too fast. So $100 comes with its own travel case. That might be a good gift for you.
And does it vibrate enough to shake the food off the fork if I'm going too quickly?
You know, I haven't tested it yet.
Todd Bookman, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Todd Bookman reports on innovation for The Pulse, and we have, of course, put links to all of these gadgets on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. Coming up on The Pulse, the gloves come off. Well, a little bit. As two distinguished academics discuss how old is too old.
Jason's response is a classic, but let's face it, those are outliers.
Yeah, no, Zeke, I know you were bothered that, you know, you don't have a good chance of a Nobel Prize or your second Nobel Prize after 75. I think you got to make sure you're putting your apples in the apple basket and the oranges in the orange basket.
Still to come on The Pulse here on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse. IBC believes in living like nothing can hold you down. But to live worry-free, you need someone to fall back on. With doctors and hospitals across the region, Independence Blue Cross is here to help. This year, you may be eligible for financial support designed to help you live fearless. More information at IBX.com or 1-800-ASK-BLUE. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Supporting WHYY's The Pulse, AstraZeneca promotes health and science education and disease awareness through initiatives such as the Young Health Program, which helps young people build personal qualities to live healthy, successful lives. Launched in the U.S. in partnership with the United Way of Delaware, the Young Health Program has reached nearly 12,000 young people since 2012. More about the Young Health Program can be found online at im40.org.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. Now, how is this for a headline sure to catch your attention? Why I Hope to Die at 75. This was the title of an opinion piece written earlier this year for The Atlantic. The author, Zeke Emanuel, he's chair of the Department of Medical Ethics and Health Policy at the University of Pennsylvania. In it, Emanuel lays out the reasons why he thinks 75 is old enough. He's not talking about ending his life at that age, but he says he believes it's the perfect age to go. Obviously, the article got a lot of response. Unrelated, but around the same time, his UPenn colleague, Jason Karlowish, also a professor of medical ethics and a geriatrician, wrote a piece for the New York Times titled "Too Young to Die, Too Old to Worry." In this piece, Karlowish describes how the singer Leonard Cohen said he would start up smoking again at the age of 80. And Karlowish uses that idea to talk about risk reduction versus the enjoyment of life and quality of life in old age. Two interesting takes, so we thought we'd bring these guys into the studio to talk about it. Zeke Emanuel started us off.
I really was trying to induce or provoke people, you might say, into thinking about what they want their life story to be, and suggesting that it isn't just more and more quantity, that it really is about what makes a meaningful life. And my strong suggestion is that you can have a very meaningful life by 75, and you don't have to be obsessed by living every additional day, and that what you should really be obsessed about is, well before that period of time, what is going to make what you do here meaningful to you, meaningful to your children, meaningful to the community in which you live. Questions we often try to push aside and ignore in our busy daily activities.
I think what we're trying to do is open up a cultural conversation rather than just simply a medical conversation about chronic disease, aging, life in America. And this is where I think Zeke and I may differ, which is I increasingly find chronologic age to be a difficult metric upon which to make decisions both for individuals and even for populations. And given the variability that you see in older adults at any given age, depending on what you're looking at. But Leonard Cohen's dance is a good example. I mean, he is now 80 years old. He's planning to go back on tour. When he was 78, he would give 2-3-hour long concerts and skip off the stage.
But Jason's response is a classic response, which is to identify people or a list of people who are beyond 75 and either still creative or still physically and mentally intact. But let's face it, those are outliers. And there is a reason that we have a bell-shaped curve, and almost all of us, the vast, vast majority of us, are going to be inside where the numbers are. And those numbers are pretty compelling, it seems to me. We have high rates, around about 50%, certainly for women, physical disability going past 75. You have very high rates of Alzheimer's and other dementias, a third to a half of the population at 85. And then if you look at creativity, Leonard Cohen is definitely an outlier. I mean, there's just a very large slew of data. First of all, we all mentally slow down.
Yeah, no, Zeke, I know you were bothered that, you know, you don't have a good chance of a Nobel Prize or your second Nobel Prize after 75. I think you got to make sure you're putting your apples in the apple basket and the oranges in the orange basket. You know, the interesting thing is as people develop disabilities, both physical and cognitive, they do adjust to them, regardless of their age, which is quite interesting. In other words, most of us, when we affectively forecast into our future of, say, life with dialysis, would say, well, that'll be horrible. And yet when we go on dialysis, life isn't that bad, and we move on. That's part of, I think, almost the spiritual accommodation to disability. And so I'd be careful when we cite stats like, you know, 50% of women over X age are disabled. The thing is, if you go and ask them about their quality of life, they'll generally tell you it's very good. And
yeah,
a lot of the issues really are around what opportunities do we give them within their disability to enjoy life.
Jason,
they're not going to get a Nobel Prize, but they can take meaning out of their life.
It's not about Nobel Prizes. I mean, I absolutely agree with you. What we end up doing is accommodating, and we lower our expectations. We lower what we want to do. We diminish. And it really is a diminishment. We create a circle, and then that circle gets ever smaller, such that we take meaning out of very small things. And I do think, actually, the accommodation is something I'm actually writing against. I don't think we should be so comfortable with, as I put it, and I admit somewhat derisively, you know, doing crossword puzzles and books on tape. That doesn't seem to me to be a full, meaningful life. Even if we say that we're happy at the moment, what we
When my patients ask me or their family members, should I do crossword puzzles to preserve my cognitive health, my next question to them is, do you enjoy them? And if their answer is, I love them, then I say, do them because you love them. If their answer is, I hate them, then my answer is, don't do them.
So
you know, there is an exceptionalism. I hear, Zeke, on your vision of aging, which, you know, if you're not working on your fifth book and next symphony, then life after 75 isn't meaningful. I think we need to be careful about the what categories of what kinds of things we think people ought to or ought not to be doing.
Look, as I say, Jason, quite clearly in the paper, this is my view of what I think life is meaningful. But I do think there are two very important points. One is, invariably, when I mentioned this argument before I wrote it and now, people always cite, they don't cite people who are happy in the study. They cite people who are creative and producing, the Verdis of the world or the Goethes of the world, who actually were productive into their 80s. They turn out to be such rare outliers. Almost no one's productive after 70 and creative after 75. And the second thing I would say is you might be happy, but one question I think that is really important in this piece is, isn't it also relevant what your kids think and how they remember you? And one of the things I find very common is that parents who end up being disabled and a burden on their families end up coloring the memory kids have. And I very explicit. The memory I want to leave is of a vital, engaged, active person, not someone who's frail and very constricted and maybe even pretty burdensome to the family.
You know,
and I think that's a very big difference. Even if I'm happy, there are many other people I'm affecting.
In American cultural history, one of the interesting phenomena that occurred in the 19th century was a transformation of thinking about aging from part of a life cycle from birth to death to a decline from one's productive age. And it's a very American ideal. We're a nation of ambitious go-getters. And in some ways, I think what Zeke's struggling with is kind of a timeless or longstanding historical and cultural issue, which is to what degree is our life part of a life cycle, or is to what degree our life part of kind of a rise and then fall? And I guess I more kind of think that we need to cultivate the virtues around a life cycle view of life rather than a rise and fall from a pinnacle.
I would have thought a life cycle view, and I, actually a lot of my writings are about the importance of living a complete life, does have the view that at the end, what you really want to be doing is passing on and not trying to desperately live as long as possible. So I got a letter back from the daughter of one of my patients who had cancer. She ended up dying at 70. She was vital all the way to the last 6 months, was a teacher and then a substitute teacher, and just a wonderful, wonderful woman. And the daughter writes that, you know, she thought it was a tragedy that mom died. And then she said, until my father developed Parkinson's disease and lived to 82. She said, you know, upon reflection, it was really her life, vital to the end, rather than his life of a lot of decline and a lot of caregiving needs that really was the right way to go. And she also noted to me that, you know, it affects how she remembers each of them.
Your Parkinson's case is a vivid one. It makes me think of many of the patients I take care of, where Parkinson's, like other neurodegenerative diseases, are often called diseases where you die twice. And I think when people do enter that phase where, if they will, they've died in mind but not body, it becomes a deep moral and existential challenge for the family. You know, one of the issues that you raised there was the daughter's experience of the burdens of caregiving. You know, when you think about it, though, we don't actually acknowledge caregivers of patients with neurodegenerative diseases as a legitimate part of the healthcare encounter. We don't accommodate time for them to be seen by the clinician. We have no quality measures set up for their well-being and how they're doing. So, you know, I can get why children and spouses of some of my patients at the Penn Memory Center often say, there's sometimes I wish, quote, he or she was dead. But I understand that that's coming not just from mourning the loss of the person, but having to try to take care of someone in a healthcare system which doesn't fully acknowledge the role of the caregiver.
As a closing statement of sorts, Jason, what do you want people to think about as they imagine themselves getting older?
What do you want to do now that's going to maximize your dignity and quality of life so that when people look back, they can say you were treated with dignity and quality of life?
And Zeke?
I want people to answer the big questions in life. What is going to be a really meaningful life for you? Think about the kind of memory you want to leave your kids.
Zeke Emanuel, Jason Karlowicz, thank you so much for coming together to talk about this tough issue.
Thank you.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Jason Karlowicz is a geriatrician and a UPenn professor of medical ethics and health policy. Zeke Emanuel is chair of the Department of Medical Ethics and Health Policy at the University of Pennsylvania.
Baby. All right, I think so.
That was great. I've been waiting.
See the town. Now I waited half my life away.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Things are about to get a little meta. What's the inner dialogue of a scientist who studies brain development in children and is also the mom of two small kids and therefore in charge to some large extent of their brain development?
I probably overanalyze what I do. Did I do the right thing? Did I get the most brain development I could have during that time? Did I teach them the most I could in terms of regulating their behaviors? Is there something I could do differently? What does the science say? And then how do I put that into practice? So, yeah, I'm constantly doing that.
Sarah Allen is a pediatric neuropsychologist at the Philadelphia College of Osteopathic Medicine. Her son Carter is 3. Her daughter Juliana is 4. She loves her work. She loves her kids. And at home, she can happily combine her mom and scientist skills to foster what she calls executive skills.
When we say thinking, we're really talking about those executive skills because it's how you use your brain. We call it the CEO of a brain. It decides what goes first, what's allowed out, what's allowed in. So it's about the front of the brain, the frontal lobe, and teaching the brain how to regulate itself.
One way to build these skills is to ask a lot of questions rather than telling kids what to do next. Allen says the holiday season offers a lot of opportunities to practice this.
One of our traditions is to bake a different kind of cookie each week from Thanksgiving through the holidays. Baking is actually a really good one for executive skill building, and that's where you get to say, you know, what order are we going to bake things in? How do we get everything out on the table? So that's really good for sequencing and kind of putting things in that different order. All right, what do we need to do now?
Make cookies.
Why do we start?
Yeah.
Okay, now, who knows? Do we know what goes in first?
Milk.
You think that one goes first, the flour? Uh-huh. How would I know if I wasn't sure? What could I look at?
The ingredients.
Oh, that's such a good idea. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Do you know what this is called? In the back here?
Yes.
What's it called?
Chocolate chips.
They are chocolate chips, and it has a recipe on it.
Flour goes first.
Chocolate chips. I bet you would want to do them right now, wouldn't you? I could tell them, this goes first, this goes second, this goes third, but now Juliana is thinking about what goes last and what comes in the middle, and that's a really big frontal lobe skills. That's all about executive skills, to be able to sequence those events. So then when she goes to plan an assignment, when she's in her kindergarten class and she needs to do her alphabet worksheet, she can decide, oh, I'm going to do this first. I'm going to put my name on it first, and then I'm going to do this worksheet, and then I'm going to do the last question last, and that gives her a sense of what order to do things. I remember we talked about doing that last time, right? Uh-oh. Putting it in. It's okay. You can keep trying. You see how it falls out? So see how you could get it in the bowl. Maybe if you turned it. What do you think? Perfect. Oh, they're delicious.
Because you spill it everywhere.
Like that?
Yeah.
It took me a while to not want to maintain control over this cooking experiment, but they do come out.
Now?
Yeah, I know you want to put it right in, but it's really important that you wait a minute. Why is it important that he waits, Jules?
Otherwise, because you absolutely can't make cookies and you get messed up.
Right, they'll get messed up if we don't wait. So it's important that he says, there's a concept called productive failure, and that's actually how kids learn the best. So they need to try and fail before they can succeed. So this is just a way of doing that. If the cookies don't come out, then they failed and they'll try again. And they learn better. As you heard her say, you know, the cookies won't come out if we don't do that. That's very meaningful to her. Turn it this way.
I will.
I'm older than him, so I can see.
I think so. It gets very messy sometimes, and you have to allow the mess. You have to allow the mistakes and allow the mess. That's hard as a parent to do. Oops. What do you think? Are these going to be good cookies or great cookies?
Great cookies.
Great cookies.
Sarah Allen is a pediatric neuropsychologist and studies brain development at the Philadelphia College of Osteopathic Medicine. Her kids Carter and Juliana are 3 and 4. So, of course, I had to try this at home with my kids, who are 4 and 6, and, well... Classic case of productive failure. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Megan Scott. It's time now for our series, Patient Files, your stories of illness, healing, and coping. This week, we hear from Michael Ross and his family. Ross is 43 years old. He's a physician, a father of two young boys. He has colon cancer and is receiving chemotherapy, but despite that, he wants to keep on doing what he loves, including running races.
Today was the Rothman 8K. Michael has done this race for the past 5 years. My name is Wendy Ross. I'm married to Michael Ross. When he said he wanted to still do it, even though he was going to be actively getting chemo, I will confess I tried to dissuade him. But when I realized he really wanted to do it, I just decided to support the effort.
My name is Michael Ross. I'm a sports medicine physician, and I happen to be a sports medicine physician who has colon cancer. Kind of a surprising diagnosis. You know, the first time I met with one oncologist, I was told that, you know, this is the survivability, you know, 50% of people make it this far. And I didn't want to hear that. I've always been active. I thought I did it. I was doing everything right. Ate well. I'm vegetarian for many, many years. Participate in triathlon. Stage four means it's spread outside the colon and to other parts of my body. So I still, even though the part of my colon has been removed that had the tumor in it, there's still some cancer cells living on the inside of my abdomen. And had surgery, had part of my colon removed. I subsequently started chemotherapy. The truth is, I don't feel terribly sick. I happen to be a guy who has cancer and takes a couple days off every week, every 2 weeks to get chemotherapy. I could sit around all day and worry about it. And I do that plenty, especially at 3 o'clock in the morning. But I think that maintaining, you know, the life that I want to maintain, I have two boys, while I can, is important.
This is Jacob, Ben.
I'm 11, and he's 9, even though I'm smaller, but yeah. My feet are big.
What's the worst part of colon cancer?
The cancer part. See, no one else finds that funny.
Yeah, I think the chemotherapy for what I have is pretty well tolerated, generally. And I feel like my tastes change a little bit. And chemotherapy kills growing cells. And so cells grow in the mouth and in the GI tract. The thing that is the most distressing right now is I get cold sensitivity. So my fingers go numb and tingly when I touch anything that's cold or if I'm out in the cold. So chemotherapy, we show up at the hospital and it's a lot of sitting around, you know, and bring the laptop, watch some movies, read a book, take a nap, you know, and there are a bunch of other people on the same floor in chairs right next to you doing the same thing. On one of our many walks, we would pass a thrift shop, and there was a ukulele in the window. And I was saying how that would be something to pass the time if I sat and learned to play the ukulele, although I don't think the other patients would be as thrilled listening to me muddle through different ukulele chords. I still got a ukulele, but I practice it at home. Prior to being diagnosed, I was competing in triathlon and sprint distance, which is going very hard, but for relatively short distances compared to some of the longer distances. And not only me doing it, but me prescribing it for patients and doing exercise testing to help people do the same thing. And now here I am. I'm like, well, I'm just excited to be out, able to go out and run. We did make shirts with a giant semicolon on the front because I have a semicolon. Part of it's gone, so.
The semicolon brigade coming in right now. The Rossman Institute 8K team.
Ladies and gentlemen.
I feel pretty good now. I think the chemo is making my vocal cords go into a little bit of spasm, so it's hard to talk, but I feel great. I can't talk.
Odds are whatever they are for you, right? If survivability from something is 75%, doesn't mean that 75% of you is going to survive. You're either going to be 100% or 0%. You've got to live your life. I feel like I'm not really as inspirational as people think. I think it's just I want to keep doing what I can do. I can do it.
Rothman Institute sports medicine physician Michael Ross and his wife, Wendy. Michael is currently undergoing treatment for stage 4 colon cancer. Laura Benchoff produced this piece.
Oh, I got to tell you, he wanted the ukulele, and I got it because I knew he wanted it. I had buyer's remorse like a minute after that ukulele came out, but then he tuned it, and I'm like, okay, maybe this won't be that bad. But yeah, it was. I was like, oh my God, what was I thinking?
Coming up on The Pulse, the mystery of tomato juice, shunned on the ground, beloved in the air.
As soon as you have it 30,000 feet, tomato juice shows, let's say, its better side.
Still to come on The Pulse here on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse and believes that everyone should make the most of every moment. That's why they offer doctors and hospitals across the region and a range of health plans designed to meet your needs. More at IBX.com. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. Actively supporting nonprofit organizations to increase disease awareness, prevention, and access to medicines in the Philadelphia region, AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. Learn more by visiting AstraZeneca-US.com.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. About 3.5 million Americans are expected to travel by plane this Thanksgiving weekend. Are you among them? Chances are you will order a beverage that you would never even look at while on the ground. Why is that? Stephen Jackson reports.
Once again, ladies and gentlemen, we thank you for attention. Flight attendants are now making their final safety.
The plane takes off. The seatbelt sign flickers out. I settle into my seat for a long flight, and the beverage cart comes rolling down the aisle.
May I offer you a beverage?
Tomato juice.
Ice or no ice?
No ice. Oh,
okay.
I never touch the stuff on the ground, but sometimes I like to drink it when I fly, and I'm not the only one. On this particular flight, the woman in the window seat in front of me is a tomato juice drinker, and someone else orders it a couple rows back. I wonder why it's so popular up here. So I called this guy.
I'm Guillaume de Sillon. I research aviation history, and when I fly, since it's not good to always drink alcohol, I go for tomato juice.
De Sillon says that tomato juice on planes is a long-standing tradition, and it all started in the early days of commercial air travel. Back then, flying could be pretty terrifying.
Cruising the sky as smoothly as a bird, you scarcely realize you are traveling faster than man has ever traveled before.
The flights were very noisy. There was a lot of vibration. You could hear the engine much more than you do nowadays. So drinking actually was a nice way of calming the nerves. Once you got bored, of course, you would drink some more. And before in-flight entertainment, such as movies, this is what people did to the extent that by the time they landed, say, from a transatlantic flight, it was not uncommon to see passengers completely drunk trying to get through customs.
Come fly with me, let's fly away.
But as jets got bigger and passenger loads increased, airlines couldn't afford to serve free booze on every flight. Plus, charging for drinks was a great way to keep people from getting belligerent. And when the industry was deregulated in the late 70s, competition got stiff, and airlines began charging for more of their services, including alcohol. Free drinks started to fade away, but mixers, like tomato juice, stayed firmly on the menu. But that doesn't explain why people drink so much of it today.
It's actually a question airlines have been asking. How is it that they have to carry tomato juice?
A few years ago, the German airline Lufthansa realized they served about 53,000 gallons of tomato juice every year. That's just shy of the 59,000 gallons of beer they serve each year, which is really saying something.
I mean, Germans are known as a beer-drinking nation, and that's one of our favorite things, and we are proud about it.
That's Ernst Derenthal, a catering executive for Lufthansa. The airline wanted to know why passengers drank so much tomato juice, so they hired a team of scientists to study it. They put people in a flight simulator, the fuselage of an old Airbus A310. It perfectly mimicked the environment at altitude, complete with cabin pressure, turbulence, engine noise, even pictures of blue sky and clouds taped to the windows. Then they ran some taste tests.
And we learned that tomato juice, being on ground level, is rather, I'm not saying moldy, but it tastes earthy, it tastes not overly fresh. However, as soon as you have it 30,000 feet, tomato juice shows, let's say, its better side.
People consistently rated tomato juice as tasting better in the fake airplane than in a normal environment. Here's why.
Flight attendants, please be seated for departure.
When you're cruising at altitude, cabin pressure is low, similar to the atmosphere 1 mile above sea level. That low pressure does a couple of things. First, your blood gets less oxygen, which dulls your odor and taste receptors. Then, your nasal mucus swells up, making it even harder to taste. On top of that, the air is really dry, around 10% humidity. This dries out your nose and mouth, cutting down your sense of taste even more. Congestion, dehydration, it feels kind of like having a bad cold. Sweets are less sweet, salty food, less salty. That's why most airplane food tastes bland, but tomato juice actually tastes better.
It shows more acidity, it has some mineralic taste with it, and it's very refreshing.
But Darenthal and his colleagues weren't satisfied. After all, most of us don't know that tomato juice tastes any different at altitude, but we order it anyway. There must be something else going on.
And so we started observing passenger behavior, and then, of course, talking to flight attendants often.
Everyone has a different reason for drinking tomato juice. Some drink it because it's filling. Others say it settles the stomach and helps with air sickness. And most people just drink it because it's there.
Many people, they have not made their mind up, just wondering, what should I drink? In 2 minutes, I will be asked by the flight attendants. And then you see somebody in front of you having a tomato juice. They say, why not? It's a good idea. Oh, I have the same as a gentleman in the other row.
Most likely, it's a combination of all these things. A little history, a lot of biology, and a dash of the unknown. For The Pulse, I'm Stephen Jackson.
Staying with the topic of taste mysteries on The Pulse, one might argue that Thanksgiving leftovers are among the most delicious things on this earth. Is it just because the cooking is over, the kitchen is clean again, and the company is gone? Or do leftovers really somehow taste better? Joining us now is Kanta Schelke from the Institute of Food Technologists. She's the founder of Corvus Blue LLC, that's a Chicago-based food science and research firm. Thank you so much for being on The Pulse.
Thank you, Macon. This is lovely to be here with you and to talk about one of my very favorite subjects, food.
Kanta, what kind of food tastes better on day 2 or 3?
Foods that contain a number of ingredients usually taste, a variety of ingredients, usually improve over time because each of the components sort of change during the cooking process, and the aromas and the flavor compounds that they release rejoin each other and form some very complex, what we call characteristics, tastes and flavors. And that's what tastes better and better over time. There's something else that happens, and that is these flavor compounds, the herbs, the spices, the reactions that take place during cooking, those compounds sort of cool back. And depending on how you have cooled and refrigerated your food, actually get back into the food and get trapped into this, you know, the starches and the proteins. The second time around, what you taste is not the distinctly different flavors, but the melded tastes. And that is what most of us call comfort food. So the mashed potato doesn't stand out, but it has also the aroma of the butter, maybe the dressing or the gravy that you had along with it. It's all now melded together and become mellow. And we humans love to taste mellow food.
What about texture? Does that change a lot? Does that change for the better, for the worse?
Texture is very important. Let's take turkey, for example. There's a reason why people ask us to remove the turkey from the oven and wait for a while. What you're doing is you're allowing the cooking to continue. But what you're really doing is allowing the protein, the collagen, the various juices to sort of cool down and solidify and trap the flavor. So as you wait, a little bit, as you wait and give it some more time, the aromas diffuse through this big bird and even the inside tastes better. In the case of leftovers, what you've done is actually chopped up the pieces into smaller pieces and hopefully put some broth on top of it. So when it cools, it picks up the aroma and the flavor of the broth and becomes tastier than the first time around.
What's the trajectory of leftovers? If the food tastes better on day one, does it taste better yet on day two? And then when does it start to not taste so great?
Most foods taste better 24 to 36 hours after they've been cooked, simply because of this continued process that allows the flavors to intermingle and the textures to ripen and mature. After that, deterioration happens. Some people like their foods a little riper, and for them, that may be good. But to the connoisseur, that food is on its way out.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Maiken. This was lovely.
Kanta Shelke from the Institute of Food Technologists. She's the founder of Corvus Blue LLC, a Chicago-based food science and research firm. Finally, on today's edition of The Pulse, we hear from 54-year-old David Silverstone of Oak Park, California. He's experiencing Thanksgiving weekend in a whole new way this year. Silverstone was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer in April of 2013.
Which at that time I truly believed it was a death sentence.
And it seemed like his worst fears would come true. Chemotherapy failed to shrink the tumor, and several West Coast surgeons told him they couldn't remove it because of its close location to an artery.
I had surgeons go so far as to tell me, you know, you have 2 to 3 months left to live, you should definitely get your affairs in order, to others saying, we don't know how long you have to live, but the risk is far greater than the benefit for us to perform this procedure. Therefore, we do not advise it.
Silverstone decided to expand his search to the East Coast, and he found Dr. Charles Yeo at Jefferson University Hospital. Dr. Yeo said, yes, he could operate on this tumor. Silverstone flew to Philadelphia, but he felt very unsure about his odds.
I truly believed I was just going through one more exercise.
The surgery was last month.
I recall the last two people's face I saw was my anesthesiologist and Dr. Yeo, and I thought to myself, you know what? I'm 54 years old. I've had an amazing life. I have two wonderful children. I'm starting to get a little choked up now. I have an amazing wife who has supported me not only through this medical issue, but throughout my life, that I'm going to go to sleep now. And God willing, I'll wake up, and whatever the outcome is, I'll deal with. And if I don't wake up, I won't know the difference. When I first woke up, I was very out of it, so to speak. I was so thankful and so in disbelief that I was awake and that I was alive and that this procedure was over. Not only was I thankful that I was alive, but I felt as if they just put me under and that I was only under for 30 or so minutes. And the first thing that came to mind was, oh my God, they opened me up. They found cancer. They were not able to operate and they closed me up. And this journey's going to continue in a negative way. And then I'll never forget Dr. Yeo rubbing my arm, saying, you're okay. We got it all. There's no more cancer in you. Go back to rest. You're okay. I'm going to go tell Lisa now, which is my wife. Thanksgiving is one of my favorite holidays, irregardless of what I've gone through. But it's going to be so much more meaningful. Thanksgiving is a time where you're not giving presents or gifts. It's truly a holiday of being with family and close friends, which is something I truly cherish. And this Thanksgiving, not only is it going to be that, but it's going to be multiplied exponentially. And I could be talking for a day of what I'm thankful for, just going through all the people who have supported me and helped me through this year and a half plus journey. So for me, Thanksgiving is going to be one of the most meaningful holidays for me going forward for the rest of my life.
David Silverstone of Oak Park, California, who recently underwent surgery for pancreatic cancer at Jefferson University Hospital. Ryan Briggs produced this piece. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Carolyn Beeler, Alana Gordon, and Todd Bookman. Gray Tennis is our intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Joel Patterson, the associate producer. Megan Pinto is our executive producer. Chris Atulo is vice president of news, and Christine Dempsey, our chief content officer. If you missed some of this show or any of our previous shows, subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. And you should come to our first birthday party with a live in-studio performance on Thursday, December 4th. You can RSVP and get more information at whyy.org/pulse live. And we always love to hear from you. Email us with your feedback, your questions, your ideas at thepulse@whyy.org. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.